Chapter 1. A Path Denied. Lost Soul. The Battle of the Walking City. The frosts always came in the dead of night, despite the best efforts of the Imperial Palace's weather management systems. They were gone by dawn. So few but those who patrolled the Eagle's Highway would ever have seen the way the thin patina of ice shone on the dark Antipode marble, as it caught the light of ships passing along the sky corridors above. In the past, many who came to the Emperor's earthly domain observed the highway from a distance and thought it to be a purely ornamental feature. It stood so far up above the precinct and the great towers of the inner palace that it seemed to float there, a ribbon of stone drifting in low clouds, defying crude gravity by the sheer beauty and wonder of its existence. It was a minor glory among the magnificence of the Terran capital, but a glory nevertheless. Wintour imagined that such thoughts had never even occurred to the Praetorian before he began demolishing the path. Dawn, in one of the endless diktats of defensive measure he had issued since returning to Terra, labelled the Eagle's Highway as both a military weakness and a waste of resources. Large sections of it had been deconstructed, and the marble repurposed for ugly battlefield uses. Talking to a wine seller of his acquaintance on the Avenue of Sacrifice, Wintour learned that the stone was now a series of gargantuan tank traps out on the catabatic slopes, and at the time the news had been enough to make him weep. That seemed like such a terrible thing, an act of martial, uncultured barbarity in the name of a war yet to arrive, a hard-souled soldier taking a chisel to a thing of transcendent splendour in order to carve himself another graceless redoubt. But now that ignominy seemed utterly trivial. Pretty marble meant nothing. Beauty meant nothing. Not when ranged against the horrors of what Wintour knew now. The secrets, he had been told, had unseated his reason. A lesser man might have gone mad to know them. Perhaps in some subtle way, he had. Wintour's thoughts inexorably slipped back towards the revelations and the dark realities lurking in the back of his mind, and the giddy, terrifying rush they brought up threatened to overwhelm him. It was as if he were being stalked by the Medusae out of ancient Hellenic myth. To look directly into the eyes of this truth would petrify his flesh and bone. His flimsy leather shoes, over-elaborate and made for soft, carpeted domiciles, slapped on the frosty stone. Wintour skidded to a halt to catch his breath, hiding in the lee of a carved griffin. The cold marble burned at the soles of his feet, and the icy air at this great altitude was hard and heavy in his lungs. Rake thin and taller than most men, on other days he would have been more graceful than his gangly form suggested. Beneath the hooded robes he wore, his colouring was that of deep sand, and above an elegant chin and a regal face, his violet-hued eyes flitted back and forth on the verge of panic. A learned observer who knew human cultures might have guessed he was of Indonesic extraction, and they would have been gravely mistaken. His heart hammered against the inside of his chest. It had taken him several days to store up enough courage to make the escape attempt, and now he was fully committed to it. Wintour did not look back the way he had come, for fear of seeing the towers and minarets of the palace. He wanted to remember them as the beautiful and unsullied things that had greeted him on his first arrival here a decade ago. He was afraid that if he gazed at them now, he would only see the lies they stood upon, and the awful reality kept hidden from the Imperium at large. If only they knew, he thought, looking away towards the lights of the petitioner's city thousands of metres below. What would the people say if they knew what I do? If they could see the truth behind the insurrection? But those were questions he could not even begin to fathom a reply for. All that mattered in this moment was flight. He had to flee the palace, put as much distance between himself and the truth, get as far away as he possibly could from him. The sound of his voice, the cadence of his footfalls, the rasp of his robes, that faint but ever-present scent of amasek in his chambers. Wintour felt this collection of elements forming into a recollection of the man, and he stamped down on them, dispelling the moment before a name took shape in his mind. If he were to think fully of that face, it would be too late. "He will know," Wintour said aloud, sucking in a deep breath to steel himself. "I won't go back." He dashed out from behind the statue and ran as quickly as he dared, keeping his head bowed, one hand fishing in a deep pocket for the stolen cipher key that would allow him to use one of the palace's transit flyers. The little craft would be able to get him to the plains. If he was quick, if this could be done before an alert was posted, he could escape. To his credit, anyone else would have been caught already. But then there were few who knew the byways of the Imperial Palace as well as Wintour did. The study and documentation of its architecture and construction had been his sole duty for the longest time. He knew how the guardsmen patrolled, and in which sectors the custodians held their vigils. It was said it would take a lifetime of study to know the dominions of the Emperor's Bastion. But that was the dedication of Wintour's existence. Or at least it had been, until the conversations began. If he could have gone back to that first day, to that chance meeting in the gardens, he would have refused the offer. The glass of fine Venusian wine, the pieces assembled on a regicide board awaiting a match.
"I have so few opponents."
"No." He spat out the word. Too close. He almost thought of the name. "Be careful." Wintour was so deep in his fear that he almost stumbled over the temporary barrier that had been erected across the access ramp to the pad. He flinched away, and a breath of wind caught his hood, pulling it back to let the long jet streaks of his hair fall loose. He gripped the cipher key so tightly that it cut into the palm of his hand. The landing stage was gone. Blinking, he cast around, momentarily afraid that he had made a mistake and set off on the wrong path along the Eagle's Highway. But no, he knew for certain that was not so. The Griffin statue confirmed it. He was in the right place. But the flyer pad was not where it should be. How could it be gone? He inched forward, pushing at the barrier, and looked down at the sheer drop where before there had been a marble platform ringed with auto services for transit craft, aeronefs, and civilian ornithopters. Then he understood. The stone had been cut with the harsh mathematics of a laser, with nubs of reinforcing flex steel protruding here and there, where the framework had been forcibly removed by combat engineers. It was another of Dawn's works, something else the Praetorian had carved off the palace to repurpose to his military whim. "I should have known that," Wintour told himself, frustration rising to the fore. "Why did I come up here? Why did I think this path would take me away?" A troubling possibility occurred to him. Perhaps he had made Wintour follow this route from the very start. That would be like him, to build an elaborate scheme just so he could prove a point, rather than merely speak the words and be done with it. The panic Wintour had been holding in broke the banks of his self-control, and he felt himself tremble as he turned back. Blocking his path was a legionary in full battle armour of the Corvus iteration, his warplate cast in the unadorned slate grey of the Chosen. A knight errant.
"Stay where you are," said the warrior.
He almost sounded uncertain.
"I won't go,"
called out the man, jerking backwards in shock. Humans were often surprised at the stealth with which a legionary could move, and this, combined with the shock effect of seeing a transhuman at close quarters, could terrify even the hardiest of them. This one did not seem robust by any measure, as he opened his long-fingered hands in a gesture of not quite surrender. A datum card dropped to the stonework at his feet, and the wind pushed it away out of reach.
"That choice is not yours to make,"
said Tylos Rubio, keeping his tone level as he removed his helmet. He hoped that looking the man in the eye might make this easier. The alert fox had said little about the fugitive, concentrating more on a wideband message to all stations that the man was to be arrested on sight and detained for questioning. He did not seem dangerous, but the psyker had too much experience of the commonplace becoming the uncanny to relax his guard, even for an instant. Rubio had chosen to delay his imminent departure from the palace in order to join the search, compelled to do so by an impulse that he could not directly identify. His bolt pistol hung holstered at his belt, and his free hand rested on the gold Ultima forged at the hilt of his force sword, the weapon quiet for the moment in its scabbard. Rubio's stance communicated a warning to any who looked upon him. He was a scion of the Legionis Astartes, and as such, danger was inherent in everything he did. Once, Rubio had served with pride in the 13th Legion, the Ultramarines, first as a psyker warrior of the Librarius, and then after the Edict of Nicaea had forbidden the use of his powers, as a line space marine. But that felt like a lifetime ago. Here and now, his allegiance was turned towards a more clandestine end, as were his more ephemeral abilities. Rubio was not just a legionary, although the genhanced warrior kind of any legion were never just anything. He was a gifted fighter on the battlefield of the metaphysical, as well as the material. A psychic hood, a complex device of crystalline matrices and psi-tuned alloys, rose up behind his head, glowing with a soft inner light. The hood had been at rest during his ascent to the Eagle's Highway, but now he was close to this human, it awoke of its own accord and pushed new awareness into his mind. Or rather, it showed him the lack of something. Rubio's eyes narrowed as he reached out with a subtle telepathic probe, reading the ebb and flow of energy around the thin man in the robes.
Nothing.
Where the colours of a human psyche should have coiled and drifted like living smoke, there was a void without depth. Rubio's psionic senses recoiled from him, repulsed by the literal antiform to his own powers.
"You are a pariah," he said.
Those of a more fanciful bent than the former ultramarine would have said the man was without a soul. But Rubio did not believe in such ephemera. Rather, he saw clearly that the fugitive was of the rare 1 in 10 million breed whose psionic trace was diametrically inverted. Where others left an imprint on the invisible tides of the Empyrean, this unfortunate had only nothingness within him. In some cases, such a being could be disturbing to the equilibrium of a psyker, even metaphysically dangerous. Rubio did not sense that threat here, however. In point of fact, the man was unlike any of the psychic nulls he had encountered before. It was impossible to grasp even the smallest sense of the alien shape of his essence.
"What do you mean by that?" The figure in the robes shook his head. "My name is A.L. Wintour. I've committed no crime. I am a sanctioned historicist in the Emperor's service. You cannot hold me against my will."
"Your recovery has been ordered by the highest authority."
As the words left Rubio's lips, the man sagged, and the colour drained from his face.
"Don't make this difficult."
Rubio extended a hand.
"Come with me. You won't be harmed."
"That is not so."
Wintour shook his head and backed away a step. His voice rose into a half-shout, half-whimper.
"I cannot go back to him. Do you understand that? I can't hear any more."
He buried his face in his hands and pressed those long fingers to his ears.
"I can't. I can't. I can't."
Rubio prepared to move. It would only take a quick motion, but he was fast enough to cross the short distance between them in half a second. He plotted the action in his thoughts. Take him by the arm, apply gentle pressure. He would need to be careful. Humans were fragile things.
"Don't resist," he warned.
"No!"
Wintour bellowed the word at him, full of fear and last-ditch defiance.
"You don't know what he tells me.
The things he shows me. The truth that cannot be denied.
The man abruptly trailed off and fixed Rubio with a firm gaze. A change came over his face, a sudden recognition.
No, I'm wrong. You do know.
He raised a hand and pointed at Rubio's face.
Yes, I see it in your eyes, Knight. Clear as daybreak. You've seen what lurks out there, haven't you? The horrors that are coming.
He whispered the last like a shared secret. The legionary was momentarily lost for a reply. The man was right. Rubio had seen horror of a kind that he lacked the words to describe. Things that chilled him to his core and sickened his heart. Those monstrous things had almost been the death of him, out in the void, aboard the vengeful spirit, the dread flagship of the War Master. And now, even though he was freshly healed and returned to battle duty, the inner scars that confrontation had left on him would never fade.
How do you know of this?
Again he tried to gain a telepathic appraisal of the man, but Wintour's strange non-self prevented any psionic reading.
He's lying to you,
hissed the trembling man.
They'll be here sooner than you think. Horus is bringing the end. The sky black with carrion flies and the stench of death.
Rubio stiffened. The mere mention of the arch-traitor was enough to send a cold thrill through his nerves. Across the planet, Terra was poised on the precipice of total war, waiting for the invasion that would soon be upon them. Out in the darkness, the greatest enemy the Imperium had ever faced was coming for the throne world and the final reckoning.
The War Master will be defeated, said the legionary,
and he meant every word.
Yes,
said Wintour, his panic rising again.
But you will still lose everything you stand for. And he knows that. He knows it.
Enough, Rubio snapped, and Wintour retreated still further.
You are bound by law on the order of Malkador, High Regent of Terra. You are one of the chosen, just as I am. So obey. Come with me now, or I will break you and drag you away.
He spoke his name. You shouldn't have done that.
Wintour's eyes filled with tears.
Please, just let me go. I'm only one person. I don't matter. But I can't hear any more. It's tearing me apart inside.
I am so very sorry, Ael.
Rubio twisted towards the sound of the new voice, pulling a good measure of his sword from its scabbard before he caught himself. His psychic hood sizzled with the bleed-off from the sudden metapathic presence that had joined them on the elevated pathway. His gaze found an old man in robes similar to those worn by Wintour, but the new arrival supported himself upon a tall staff of black iron, topped by a basket of muttering flames about a carved metal eagle. Malkador, last of the Sigilites, had arrived without hint or indication, and for a moment Rubio experienced the same shock that Wintour must have felt upon seeing him. Not for the first time, Rubio wondered if the Sigilite was actually present by any measurable means of understanding. Malkador's immense psychic might, second only to that of the Emperor himself, dwarfed the warrior librarian's powers. It was said that he could kill a man with a look, and Rubio believed it. But in this moment, the expression on the Sigilite's face was only sadness.
This is always so difficult, Malkador said quietly. This is not what I want.
Then why burden me?
Wintour screamed back the question, accusing him with each word.
I did not ask to know. I yearn for the days before when I was ignorant and unnoticed.
Yes,
said Malkador, glancing to Rubio, then away again.
But it was necessary.
He took a long, despondent breath.
Please, Hael, return with me. You are needed.
Rubio had never heard the Sigillite speak to anyone in this tone. The Regent of Terror would cajole, he would influence, he would demand, but he would never make a request as he did now. His manner was almost beseeching. Wintour drew himself up, and at length he shook his head.
That may be so, but I know too much ever to follow you again.
Then, before Rubio could react, the man in the robe let himself fall backwards over the safety rail and into the cold mountain air. The warrior surged forward, reaching out to snatch at a fold of the fugitive's flapping robes before he was beyond reach. But Malkador spoke again, the single word, "No," and Rubio became a statue, unable to move. He could do nothing but watch Wintour fall silently away, captured by the gusts and carried towards the ragged minor peaks. The tumbling figure grew smaller and smaller, until it crumpled against the top of a high tower in a blink of crimson.
"I could have saved him," Rubio said, as control of his body was returned.
"That ship had already sailed."
The Sigillite gave a shake of his head. Rubio hated the sudden sense of powerlessness that had passed through him. It seemed a pointless waste of human life to let this poor, tormented fool plummet to a bloody death. If his value had been so trivial, then why was Malkador's attention upon him? The Sigillite pulled the question from the warrior's thoughts.
"A tragic chain of events," he clarified.
But the explanation seemed rote and hollow. The deep and honest sorrow Rubio had seen in Malkador's old eyes dithered there for a moment longer, and then it was gone, melted away like the frost on the marble.
You do not need to understand, Rubio.
The Sigillite spoke over him.
You will not speak of this matter again, and you will not question what took place here.
The words resonated with subtle psychic force, embedding themselves in his thoughts. He found himself saluting, his fist to his chest.
Your will, Regent.
Malkador walked away, circling behind him as he gazed off towards the southern sky.
And don't you have somewhere else to be? Your fellow knights errant have need of you.
Rubio gave a reluctant nod, and turned again to face the Sigillite, framing a reply. But he was alone. The narrow iron corridors of the walking city rang with panic, and all Vardas Ison could hear were the screams of the people and the droning of the things that were consuming them. The mobile tech nomad settlement sat atop a gigantic 20-legged platform that trudged on a looping course towards the equator and back, kicking up huge plumes of stale dust from the parched earth beneath its colossal feet. But today the constant grinding noise of its motion was blotted out by the sound of terror and destruction. He tried to keep himself in the moment, but it was difficult to stop his thoughts from flitting around, ranging back through the day in some attempt to seek out the precise fulcrum, the exact moment when it had gone awry.
"Get back, damn you!"
Varen shouted at the civilians, clustering around them, the tallest of the humans barely reaching the height of their elbows.
"Clear my line of fire, or so help me, you'll be ash as well."
His harsh words sent a wash of fear through the people, and they shrank back like a retreating tide, their feet ringing on the rolling metal deck as they flowed around the immobile rocks of the two grey-armoured legionaries. Ison could have projected a calm over them if he had wanted to, broadcasting it from the codicier's psychic hood mounted behind his head. But to do that would rob potential and focus from his combat abilities, and he feared he needed weapons more than the civilians needed comfort.
"Here they come,"
Varen hissed, bringing up the twinned Volkite Serpenta pistols in his hands. The other legionary had taken the Marsborn guns from the weapons locker aboard their Storm Eagle, eschewing the use of the power sword sheathed upon his back in favour of the deflagrating beam weapons. It was true the guns were better suited to the close combat environs of the walking city's passageways, but Ison thought it more likely that the former World Eater's legionary chose them because he liked the destruction they wrought. Ison made no secret of his ill will towards Mesa Varum. For all his readiness to break away from his Primarch, the bloody-handed traitor Angron, Varun was still very much a son of his violent and hate-fueled legion. That the ex-captain kept to his oaths to the Emperor and Terror against the turning of his battle brothers was laudable, but it didn't change the colour of his heart. Only recently returned to active duty, after emerging from the healing Susan coma, his fresh suit of scars gave him a permanent snarl that Ison felt revealed the truth of his crude and brutish nature. By his lights, Ison considered Varun a poor fit among the knights errant of Malkador's chosen. The dislike went both ways. Varun thought Ison was haughty and inconstant, and reminded him of it at any opportunity. A point of particular contention was the name of Ison's origin legion. He had not deigned to give it to any of the other knights, and Varun carved trivial amusement out of his attempts to goad him into a reveal.
"Stay focused, Peacock," Varun demanded.
The casual insult was made to suggest Ison might be a son of the Phoenician, and he ignored it.
"That is all I do," he replied, reaching out with his psychic ability to feel for threats in the web of corridors around them.
Burning, indefinite shapes seared his sensorium as they closed in on them. The attack on the Walking City had begun, as many of these assaults did, in the halls of a makeshift church. Hidden from sight deep in the lower levels of the great ambulatory metropolis, a chapel dedicated to the cult of the Imperial Truth had flourished. Ordinary people, terrified beyond reason by the threat of the War Master's invasion, came together to seek solace and direction, and the preachers of the truth gave it to them. They told the lost and fearful that the ruler of mankind was, in point of fact, a god-emperor, a deity who had created himself. He would lead them to salvation, if they believed. And in these turbulent days, when the end of all things endangered not just Terror but the galaxy beyond, there was no shortage of those who needed a palatable response to all their terrors. But in recent months, Malkador the Sigillite had dispatched Ison and others of the Knights Errant and the Chosen to cult sites across the planet, and on each occasion they had encountered incidents of bloodletting and destruction. What they found were the harbingers of unspeakable things that until now had been confined to worlds beyond the light of Sol. It was happening with greater frequency. With each one of these incidents they put down, two more occurred. What was transpiring here on the Walking City was the worst of it yet, and even with the force of four knights errant and a squad of Malkador's best chosen armsmen, Ison wondered if they would be up to the challenge. Some among the group spoke of these events as signs that the long-awaited invasion was almost upon them, the suggestion being that the malign shadow of the War Master's influence in the Immaterium was pressing hard on the metaphysic barriers erected about Terror by the Emperor himself. Ison imagined those invisible shields, no longer seamless and perfect, but marred by tiny cracks, through which a strain of malevolent power could still squeeze through. There was always a church at the heart of it. As the Emperor's grand secular revolution had wiped out the old religions of ancient days, he had sown the seeds of the cults that now worshipped him. Ison wondered how a being of such incomparable power could not have foreseen such a happening. But then the Emperor had never expected his sons to turn against him either. Or had he? The manifestations bloomed in the halls of the Imperial cult with such potency that the connection could not be ignored. The creatures of the warp were clearly drawn to these pious gatherings, and Ison imagined they could taste the raw need of the desperate Terrans as sharply as Salakians might taste blood across kilometres of ocean water. He had known it the moment they landed on the shifting platform atop the multi-legged frame of the massive mechanical city, felt the piercing sharp pain behind his eyes as a droplet of blood escaped his nostrils.
Attackers!
Varan's battle roar shattered Ison's reverie, and the other legionary opened fire on the mad horde of bloated figures that came falling through the hatches and into the corridor before them. It was Helig Gallor, with typical Death Guard aplomb, who had named these transformed foot soldiers the Flyblown. Humans bitten and transfigured by exposure to the mutagenic venom of infernal pests, they were mindless killing machines that lived only to destroy or to build their numbers by infecting others. In a closed environment like the Walking City, they were akin to a fast-acting virus. If not burned out, that infection could spread unchecked. There was no cure, only excision. Varan's Volkite guns shrieked white fire and blasted the front rank of the Flyblown into ashen gobs of matter, but their fellows stamped their remains into the deck and stumbled on. The creatures were ugly and misshapen. Something of the people they had once been could be determined by their clothing and the tone of their skin, both now stretched to the point of splitting by the swelling of diseased tissues beneath, but no features were recognisable. Burst human eyes became insectile, turning into grotesque multifaceted jewels. Tiny flickering wings and mandible parts emerged from boils on bare flesh, quivering and rasping as the mutation took hold. Ison's bolter barked, the concussion of the shot deafening many of the civilians crowding behind him. He could feel their terror churning like boiling water. The passageway beyond was a dead end, and if the knights errant fell against the mass of the Flyblown, the humans would be fodder for the mutants. The mass reactive rounds from his gun blasted through the creatures, but each one he killed erupted with quivering new life as buzzing streams of birthing flies swarmed out to sully the air. Varan's ray weapons turned everything they touched to powder, but even he was in danger of being overwhelmed.
"Can't hold this off much longer," snarled the other warrior. "Stop pissing around like a tyro and do what you have to do!"
The psychic hood at the back of Ison's head glowed at the unvoiced thought in his mind. "If I use it here, the civilians will be at risk."
"Forget them!"
Varan retorted.
"Just do it!"
Damn him for being right. Ison's jaw set as he let his bolter hang free on its sling, and he brought his hands together in a prayer-like gesture. Tiny jolts of crimson-white fire collected in the crystal matrix of the hood, growing to shimmer down his arms, gathering around his fingers. The Flyblown were almost upon them now, and Varan's pistols were sizzling with built-up heat. Ison closed his eyes and mouthed a mnemonic.
"In the angel's name I smite thee."
A blinding blaze of red lightning leapt from his hands and washed out across the narrow corridor, sweeping up and through the mass of the Flyblown. Backwash from the blast writhed around him, buffeting Varan and striking dead a handful of civilians too close to get away. But the psychic weapon did the deed, atomizing the mutants in a single wave, turning them and their insect progeny into black dust. As the blast faded, the dark ash settled to the deck in a deep drift. Varan granted the enemy the only honour they were due, and spat into the mass of their remains. He turned and eyed the young whelp psyker.
"You're good for something,"
admitted the former World Eater's legionary, coming as close as he ever would to anything resembling contrition.
"I was wrong. You can't be one of Fulgrim's. Those braggarts are useless."
He fell silent as he realised that Ison was taking no notice of him, staring away down the corridor.
"Don't ignore me, boy."
Ison shook his head.
"Something else is coming," muttered the psyker.
As the warning left his lips, the corridor around them set to a thrumming vibration. The sound was so bass and low that it made Varan's teeth hum in his jaw, and around him he saw many of the civilians clasping at their noses and ears as blood trickled from the orifices. He clamped his mouth shut and triggered the gas vents on the breeches of his serpenters. But even as the cool down cycled, he knew he would not have time to dwell. From around the far corner of the corridor came a colossal rough-edged shadow that spilled over every surface. Buzzing like chainsawed blades, it was a huge, dense swarm of carrion flies. The mass of the insects was great enough to deform metal where it impacted, and it befouled the air with a cancerous corpse odour. Only one of Varen's pistols answered the trigger when he squeezed it, both of the guns still radiating great washes of heat that he could feel through the palms of his gauntlets. The single Volkite beam bored through the swarm, killing part of it, but the rest of the mass seethed and parted around the blast.
"Got another one in you!"
Varen shouted, nodding towards Ison's psychic hood. The younger warrior was already gathering his preternatural power anew, but the glow was weaker than before, and Varen suspected it would not save them a second time.
"Eaten alive by flies."
It was no way for a gladiator's son to perish. He had not survived a bitter climb to maturity on Bot, endured brutal warfare on Susa and Shazik, and the breaking of his own oaths just to die unremarked in a plasteel tunnel surrounded by wailing humans. He would keep firing the guns, then. He decided this as the overload warning icons on their grips flashed crimson. Yes, keep firing until the weapons in his hands exploded. Volkite flame would consume everything.
"It's all of one mind," Varen heard the psycho mutter. "A single swarm consciousness."
"Then we'll die killing it,"
he shouted, and opened fire again.
"Not today, brother,"
the words came over the vox.
"Look sharp."
Across the corridor, where the metal wall became the outermost hull of the walking city's construction, a shimmering sword blade burst through the steel with a howling screech. Thick yellow sparks flew as the blade cut a molten-edged V, and then the weapon withdrew. Ison was already herding the surviving civilians back towards the rent in the wall, as ceramite-clad fingers wrenched at the glowing cut and pulled the metal back from the outside, as if flaying the pelt from an animal. A gust of icy cold air blasted in through the tear in the hull, and Varen saw a figure silhouetted there, a legionary in grey, with a smoking sword in one hand, and about his head an armour cuirass detailed with a brass imperial aquila.
"Get them out!"
shouted Nathaniel Garrow, wrenching a melter bomb from a hook on his belt. A wild laugh burst from Varen's mouth, and he drew back, still firing, ignoring the burning pain through his gauntlets. The swarm wavered, as if the mass of insects sensed what was about to happen. He was the last through the rip in the hull, and as he passed Garrow, the other knight-errant pounded a fist on his shoulder pauldron.
"Gala is on the grav platform,"
Garrow shouted over the roar of the wind and the screaming buzz of the swarm, pointing his sword downrange.
"Regroup! I'll be right behind you."
But Varen slowed his pace. He wanted to watch. Garrow flicked a switch on the melter device and slung it back through the tear in the walking city's flank. The dull green cylinder vanished into the midst of the carrion fly horde and detonated. Pale yellow fire thundered through the framework and the decking, and later Varen would swear that he heard the insects scream. The walking city lurched, several of its supporting legs stumbling into the slopes of a steep mountain, and across on the far side of the great moving platform, sheets of ice and dislodged snowpack sloughed off the rock and collided with it. With the deck shuddering beneath them, Varen and Garrow sprinted the last few metres to a floating service platform, hovering alongside. Garrow, serving as the Sigillite's agentia primus among the knights errant, was commander of this mission, and he would have been within his rights to chastise Ison and Varen for almost getting themselves killed. But that wasn't his way. The former Death Guard battle captain and the hero of the Eisenstein was unlike the warriors Varen had served under in the 12th Legion, never quick to his rage, never leading by fury when reason could serve as well. It had taken him a while to get used to it, but in truth, there would always be a part of Mesa Varen that expected death to meet him. When his Primarch and his Legion had broken faith with the Imperium, Varen's refusal to follow had started the pendulum swinging on a clock that counted down his days. Climbing aboard the sputtering, overloaded grav platform, he spied Helig Galor, another knight-errant from Garrow's old Legion, at the controls, and threw him a nod. Did Garrow, Ison, and Galor think of their time as Varen did of his? His lips parted in a feral grin.
I'll probably be dead before I ever have the chance to ask them.
Go! Called Garrow, and the platform shot forward, up and around the walking city's eastern quarter. Varen shoved a few whimpering civilians out of his way so he could get a better look at the metropolis. He estimated over a third of the city was on fire, although it was hard to be sure if the black smoke he saw was from conflagration or if it was more of the gargantuan insect swarm. The moving construct had lost one leg on the western side, and it appeared to be stumbling forward on an uncontrolled course. Ahead of it, the walls of a steep-sided valley were narrowing.
"Are we retreating?"
Varen asked of the air. He glanced at the handful of civilians.
"This is a pitiful number to count as rescued." "We are regrouping,"
Garrow countered, as Galor brought the grav platform up and over the walking city's spinal boulevard.
"Look there."
Again, he pointed with his power sword, and Varen spied the target at once, a towering column of shimmering darkness that did not move as smoke did. As he watched, the legionary saw the swarm thicken and solidify.
"It's taking on the shape."
"Billions of those carrion flies merging together," said Ison. "I have an inkling of the enemy's intention." He glanced at Garrow. "You won't like it." Varen felt a jolt of cold understanding.
"It's going to infest the city's machinery, just like it bred inside the Flyblown."
"The World Eater has it," agreed Ison. Gala frowned.
"Can they do that?"
"We have seen them co-opt organic forms," Garrow said gravely, "and corrupt the inorganic. I do not doubt these things have the power to do more."
He turned to Galor.
"Helig, find somewhere to set us down, then give the controls to one of the civilians."
Varen kept his eyes on the swarm form.
"So how do we kill it, then?"
He gave his pistols an irritable shake. They were near useless to him now, so he let them drop and drew his sword. "In the middle of that is the first victim of the carrion flies. The first human they infected," said Ison. "I sense the malignancy in the core, like a blighted beating heart. We kill that one,
and that will be the end of it."
Galor did not sound convinced, and Varen shared his scepticism.
"We'll find out," said Garrow.
And then he showed a gallows humour smirk.
"After all, we're still writing the book on this kind of war."
"I don't want to perish before we reach the last page," said Ison.
"Ha!"
retorted Varen.
"Speak for yourself,"